You're listening to the Liminalist, the podcast between. I'm Jason Horsley. This week was the fourth part of an ongoing exploration discussion of Maurice Burman's Wandering God, A Study in Nomadic Spirituality with Tim Kay. Into Jung, isn't it?
Yes, just briefly though.
Just briefly. Well, he long enough to take him to task. I was tempted to, in fact, I intended to scan the section and send it to my brother-in-law because he's a Jungophyte or a Jungophile, or both. And I've, well, as you probably have picked up in the past few years, I've started to think that Jung can't be that great because he just seems so compatible with a general mindset that I don't think is that great, if you know what I mean. So I did find it very interesting. Burman, with a few short, sharp strokes, did potentially cut Jung off at the knees. Anyway, so where do you want to start? I marked something in the margins on page 119.
Okay. I'll start on page 117 because I think he has a good summary here. Mm-hmm. So far, I'll just go read through. Let's see how much of it. Yeah. So it's 117 and 118. Okay. So Burman says, I have been arguing for the existence historically of two basic constellations, hunter-gatherer society, or more precisely, immediate return economies, whose conception of the sacred is diffuse, paradoxical, and horizontal. An agricultural civilization, or more generally, delayed return economies, whose notion of the numinous is vertical, ranging from a generalized sacred authority to the intense experience of unitive trance. I have also argued that the pattern of horizontal versus vertical religious experiences, not coincidentally, roughly duplicated in the pattern of relative egalitarianism versus social inequality, and that all of this in turn is tied into child-rearing patterns. Multiple caregiving tends to create a less steep gradient child, and in addition, the mother and hunter-gatherer societies focuses on the infinite much less because she is directly involved in the social and economic activities of her society. In delayed return economies, the woman's economic role is much reduced. She becomes a professional mother, especially with the narrow birth spacing that is concomitant with a secondary lifestyle. This entails a too strong focus on the infant, giving rise to the hallowed presence phenomenon discussed by Erik Erikson. To complete the cycle, infants raised in such a context get imprinted for charismatic experience. That is, they learn to see sacred authority as expressive of the highest truth, which then serves to reaffirm the vertical social order. Men caught up in this configuration feel the need to be heroic. And when we combine this with the fear and insecurity that is endemic to delayed return economies, and with sibling rivalry and the need for intense parental investment, we get a configuration of aggressive subgroups, command, obedience relations, and prisoner's dilemma situations that characterize the power structures of the Neolithic age and beyond. This is, of course, a kind of rough-hewn outline, but on the whole, it would seem to be a fairly accurate summary of the negative aspects of life and civilization. So he continues, for the point I'm leading up to here is that we are living within a Neolithic mindset that has some validity in terms of cognition and perception, but that also represents a serious distortion. It's not merely that we have lost spontaneity in favor of institutionalized life, but that since the late Paleolithic, our very thinking process has been skewed in a religious direction, something that is generally hard for us to recognize. The insistence on certainty, sacred authority that characterized the Neolithic now shows up in the daily newspapers of the Western industrial nations and in the speeches of their politicians, who can seem to think only in formulas. Indeed, Ronald Reagan saw nothing wrong as president in replying to questions at press conferences by reading slogans off of flashcards that he had assembled in front of him. More to the point, the American public found his replies acceptable, even wise. And when we turn to those who seek to change the dominant culture, new paradigm advocates or promoters of postmodernism, multiculturalism, and the like, we don't seem to do much better. It's oppositional logic and a new set of slogans all the way. A different reality, but with our crowd now in charge. Whether modern or postmodern, our world is caught up in a consciousness that has its origins in the sacred authority complex as the source of truth. We are all, in Eric Hoffer's memorable phrase, true believers.
Have you read that book, Hoffer? Oh.
Yeah, it was many years ago, though.
Yeah, I read it a few years ago. It made it into Prisoner Infinity. So, yeah, that's quite a quite a mouthful, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And seeing as the subject of the chapter is the Great Mother and the Goddess thing, it does seem fair to zero in on that he's that diagnosis of our society, he's centering it in the creation of professional mothers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You have any thoughts on that?
Well, I got some personal ones. I don't know how personal I want to get, for the sake of, you know, those involved, but I'm certainly familiar with that. I feel as though I've spoken to quite a few women in my life who were very firmly identified with the role of mother, and specifically I've talked to them during the period where their children are growing up, and they're asking the question, who am I if I'm not a mother? So I feel as though I'm quite familiar with that existential dilemma that women enter into when their children grow up, which would seem to confirm this culturally endorsed idea that for a woman, being a mother is it. And there certainly do seem to be some positives in that, in terms of, I'm particularly thinking of my sister, that's why I say it's quite a personal area to be going into, but that's the mother who I've most closely observed. Not counting my own, I wasn't really able to observe my own mother being a mother because, you know, I wasn't in a position to observe it more objectively. That's obviously the most imprinting thing, and I mean this, the idea of a mother who's a woman who is becomes very selfless as a mother, as the primary caregiver, and kind of gives up everything to care for the child, which my mother didn't do. My sister was closer to that model, and combined with the fact that her husband died when her child was only two, so she had to be both parents. She had to provide the service of both parents, and I think in many ways she did a very good job, and certainly I think it's probably true that she, as other women, and presumably men to a lesser extent, discovered a way of being more altruistic, of making her own needs secondary and making the child's needs primary. And all of that seems like it's a positive thing. But the flip side of it, or part of that same dynamic, seems to me that putting the child first and putting oneself second would then lead to this over-identification with the role of mother, like one is experiencing oneself primarily or almost exclusively in relationship to the child. Mm-hmm. And so all of that, well, I mean, my sense around this is there's a lot of status in being a mother.
Well, you mentioned last time about your father who really didn't want to be a parent. Did you ever get the sense that that was the case with your mother?
Yeah. Definitely. Not to the same extent. I mean, my father, it was just blatantly obvious the whole time, whereas my mother was, hot and cold. But she definitely resented being a mother and expressed it in a number of ways. I remember around cooking, I mean, one of the consistent things around cooking right through to the end, and not coincidentally, the end was her dying of starvation. So she definitely had a neurotic relationship to food that eventually was the death of her. But around cooking, she was a very good cook, and she put a lot into cooking and would set herself up that she had to cook a lot, but she claimed to hate it. And she would always express her frustration and irritation with having to cook. And so I think that that was the tip of a deeper thing in terms of her experience of being a mother, that she really wanted to be that. And in some ways she was able to be, but in other ways she really wasn't and really resented it. And was more drawn to being a free spirit, an independent spirit, slash itself, a selfish person. Not a very nurturing person, my mother.
Where did that stem from? Just her upbringing, I assume?
Well, her mother was alcoholic and half crazy, and I remember her. And she didn't really know her grandfather, her father. And she was sent to convent school when she was very young, so she grew up with nuns, which can be pretty harsh. Yeah.
So this was a classic pendulum swinging in the other direction. Because of a chaotic household, a lack of a strong father figure, and an oppressive educational environment.
Well, what's the pendulum swing here? Are you thinking of my sister?
No, I was talking about your mother. So you're, at least the way I read what you're saying is that given your mother's upbringing, she used, and you said she wanted to be a free spirit. So she was rebelling against all that she came from. And she didn't want any of that responsibility or getting enmeshed in any of that.
Yeah, fair enough. I hadn't thought of it that way, but yeah, I mean, she was unusually independent. She moved to New York when she was only when she was quite young, 20 or 19 or something, and was stealing and traveling cross country. Ended up in New Orleans, where she met my father and married him 3 days later. Sort of proto hippie. This was in the 50s, late 50s. Yeah.
So then your sister turned out differently.
Yeah, my sister got the brunt of our mother's bad parenting, I would say, because she was the first, and she was a girl, and I think, in any way, I mean, I would say anyway, without going into too much detail there, that probably, well, of course, it's all there are different, negatives. So as sons, we got more enmeshed. We were more surrogates, husband surrogates. But in any event, I think my mother was particularly incompetent as a parent when, for my sister. And but she was quite happy to be a grandmother, although still quite pretty erratic and unreliable as a grandmother.
So,
And yeah.
sorry to interrupt. I find it
Yeah.
interesting. She didn't want to be a mother, but she wanted to be a grandmother.
Well, that's
So
quite
where
common.
did that come from? I've always wondered about that.
Well, that's quite common. I mean, it's of course, being a grandmother, a bit like being an uncle, I suppose. One can have the fun parts without any of the back-breaking work, the heavy lifting. Plus, it's 20, 30 years later, and so by that time, well, a lot more ready for the role of caregiver. Yeah. But she was pretty impatient as a grandmother too, but it doesn't matter so much. Grandmother isn't the primary caregiver. But anyway, I mean, to bring it back to the central thing, like I've been aware of having a certain reservations around mothers and motherhood and trepidation around mothers for quite some time, at least 20 years, I would say, and it's clear to me that part of it is, having had a crazy alcoholic mother. Obviously, that would give me a bad impression of mothers, but it's not only that, I'm sure of it. There was a lot of conflict, tension between my sister and I when she was raising her daughter, who's been on the podcast too, Emerald. Because although I wasn't there very often, I was still the primary male the fi primary father figure in Emerald's life as the uncle, because my Sebastian was completely uninterested. So yeah, there was some tension around that, and I felt that my sister was spoiling her daughter a lot. But in a more general sense, there's this feeling I've had for a long time that mothers have a certain kind of power and a certain kind of status that kind of brooks no questioning. And I've felt a certain resentment for that, but also skepticism. Like, is it really, are you really such a great mother? Is motherhood really this sacred thing? I just felt, because we live in a culture where the mother is sanctified. And no doubt that's, I don't know how much Berman gets into the specifics of that in this chapter, but I assume he must refer to it because it's very, it's just part of our culture, isn't it?
But especially in recent years, the lionization of single mothers has been, particularly here in the States. I can't speak for elsewhere, but the lionization of single mothers is that you're so heroic, and there's never any mention about why a father's not in the picture. Quite possibly she's a widow. Okay, I'd cut the woman some slack for that. But if she frivolously divorced her husband, or she was cheating on him, he dumped her, or whatever it is. But regardless of how she ends up in that position, it's just that, oh yes, you're so heroic, and you have all these services that are available even before, in the case of like a divorced mother, that really buoys up the single mothers, and it just cuts fathers out of the picture. They're just an appendage, if that. And then, I've been following this issue for many years, and just seeing it myself, seeing the fallout that happens from just single mothers. And then you have to wonder, is that, touching on what you had just said about, is motherhood really that great? You have some kind of status as a mother, but look what you produce by not having a strong father figure and being a shit mother on top of it.
Well, I mean, to jump to a controversial framework right away, if we're not already in it, there seems to be a correlation. I mean, bad mothering, one of the, in my experience and observation, one of the central elements in that is narcissism, a narcissistic mother. And I think that there is a way for a mother to be narcissistic while at the same time doting on the child, because the child is a reflection. It's almost like a variation on the narcissist myth. Rather than gazing at his own reflection, the mother is gazing at her own child, boy or girl, as a reflection of her own being, and that can be narcissistic. And clearly, the reification of a mother would, it could stem from, but it also would reinforce any narcissistic tendencies that a single, perhaps traumatized woman might already have towards narcissism or egotism, to give it a more general term. And I don't think that they're incompatible. I think that's where my skepticism comes in, that a woman can be a very good mother in quotes, as in ticking all the boxes, I mean, probably not all of them, but enough of them, while at the same time there's an egotism underneath it. And maybe this relates to, I mean, the larger thesis in Berman's book does seem to sort of circle around the question, or questioning the idea of the individual at all, the reification of the individual, because he's talking about how having a just the culture in which the mother becomes the central care, primary caregiver, and therefore a professional mother, somehow leads to the creation of charisma and of the need for heroic acts and so on. That seemed that the sort of the larger thesis for that seems to be that it's the creation of a narcissistic identity.
Right. I would also say that it's also connected to what he has said before already about just the child rearing is separate. Last time we covered is that the Japanese, the way they raise their children is with the parents for a much longer period, closer, versus Western parents who, as soon as the child is old enough, you stick him in a crib in a separate room. Or maybe it's in the same room with the parents. I've seen that too, but it's separate from the parents, and you're trying to push the child to be as independent as possible at an early age.
All right, well, my sister didn't do that. It's all very, it's unmapped for me, and I imagine it's unmapped in our culture generally. She didn't, she kept her daughter, let her daughter sleep in her bed for years and even into her teens sometimes. And I just thought that was just so unhealthy, and I really had a strong kind of revulsion for it. But, as I say, it's unmapped, and the Japanese have this tradition. Maybe it's not such a bad thing. Maybe I was wrong about
In the case of your niece, what, she's what, early 20s now, late teens, early 20s.
early 20s.
So do you see any positive correlation between her sleeping with your sister as the mother for much longer versus had she been put in the crib or pushed to independence earlier on?
Well, I don't, I can't, I'd have to sort of turn it into a science project and really analyze it, which I'm not inclined to do. But certainly, I mean, I can see that my niece is unusually attached to her mother still in her 20s. But I can also see that she's unusually healthy and conscientious and responsible, and in just many ways mature, and has turned out much better than I did at that age, or my sister did. So, and she's in a strong, loving relationship with a man. So all in all, she turned out right well, as Kunstler would say. And that, so that's the larger thing, right? But as terms of trying to break apart a specific, because there are certainly ways in which she's stuck, and I can see that she's probably going to have a difficult time. I mean, who doesn't, right? But there may be something still that she hasn't come up against in terms of being over enmeshed with her mother, because that's still on, that game between them. I was just in Spain with the two of them, and it wasn't bad at all, but I could still observe that dynamic between them, this alliance. And it's hard for me not to be skeptical about that, because I didn't have it. And as a boy child, I'd have been better off having it with my father anyway. It seems to me that having an alliance with a parent wouldn't be a bad thing per se. It's just that it also could seem to be a way for neither party to fully grow up or fully individuate.
Well, in the case of your niece, one could say is the way she was raised is unusual for Western culture. So therefore she's ill-fitted for it. Versus, as per usual, if she had been pushed to become independent, then she would not be so enmeshed with her mother, but then she would have other complexes. Downsides to that.
Yeah, that's possibly true. And even, I mean, I can see my influence on her quite strongly, considering particularly how little time we spent together in total. It was all, whatever it was, but it was, I mean, I was there every year. She saw me every year for her whole life, but in those early years it was only for a few weeks each year. Later on it was for longer. But in any event, I certainly had a strong relationship with her from the start, and I, even as a child, I was introducing her to my perception of things. As a child, it was fairies and magic and so on, which was compatible with my shamanic viewpoint. And then later, it was more to do with my worldview and my skepticism about things. And she's certainly grown up. She's more like me than her mother in that regard. She's very, very skeptical, very suspicious, very aware, and to finish it off, responding to your point, she's not socially adapted, really. I mean, she is in the essential way. She's independent, but she really has a very difficult time with the nature of society as it is. She hates it, is the short version.
Yeah. Not surprising, I guess. Runs in the
No,
family.
well, it runs in the family, and there's a lot to hate as well. But as you're saying, most kids do adapt, and they and she has gone to college, so she's doing more conventional than I ever did. But in her attitude to the world, I would say she's even more violently opposed to it, or at least as violently opposed to it as I was at that age.
Well, before we get into Jung, I just wanted to make another comment about the professional mother. What stood out for me is, based on what you had said before, is, yeah, one wonders if the woman did not have a job, if she was not a career-minded woman. I mean, truly a career-minded woman, rather than being sold a false bill of goods, that she wanted to be a mother more than anything, but she was led down a primrose path to something else. So if she was the professional mother, but then the children grow up, then what does she do with herself? Or, as you touched on, is that in the process of it, say when the kids are old enough, 6, 7, or 8, whatever it is, where they can amuse themselves and are not so attached to her all the time, then she starts to question, well, is this all there is of the life of a mother, type of thing. Whereas going back to what Berman has mentioned before about the hunter-gatherer societies, where the children were, we hesitated, we skate around the term passed around among all the people that were in the tribe. It's a much more diffuse parenting style. So the mother is, okay, so I have a child, but I'm not focusing on the child 24/7. It's there are other people that intervene, including the father, but also the extended family and the tribe that are parenting the child, and the child is just going back and forth. If, I would assume he doesn't specifically talk about it. The child knows who its parents are and goes back to them, but it's not with them all the time. So this diffuse parenting style alleviates in some ways the mother, because then the mother is more involved in the doings of the tribe and the society. But then in this case, for Western society, when you have the mother, I'm gonna go back to my own experience, is that my mother, when I was born and my sister was born, she took time off to raise us until we were old enough for us to go back to work, about a year or two. And she had a job where she could always go back to it. It wasn't that she quit her job and then she would have to go find something else, which is much more the case now than it was 50 years ago. But then both my sister and I went to the same school she worked at. She was the secretary. So going to school was just going with my mom there. And I said goodbye to her at the office and I just walked up the hall to my classroom, and that continued for about 8 years until I went to high school. So I have to wonder, using Berman's language, is this, if the school and the teachers and everybody else that was in it kind of was an analog to hunter-gatherer societies, where there was more of a sense of that. I saw my school friends every year because we progressed, and then I saw the teachers, and the teachers were friends with my mom. So it was this much more diffuse type of thing, instead of I get on the bus and I go halfway across town to school and I have to make my way there and then come back. Makes me wonder sometimes.
Well, let's press on. I had a whole bunch of thoughts, but I know that's going to keep happening, so let's just press on.
Okay. All right. Let's go to page 119 with the Jung cult. Okay. So this is where he rips into Jung. So I think you had some comments. I'll let you take the lead on that.
Well, I got the beginning of that page about the goddess. On the level of popular culture, great numbers of people have uncritically absorbed a Jungian feminist mythology about a goddess religion whose basis in historical reality is, with a few exceptions, quite shaky, but that has therapeutically become so central to their identities that any critique of that mythology is too threatening for them to entertain. Therefore, some degree of stripping away of the accreted layers of this pseudo-history will be necessary, etc., etc. And then the Jung cult, the next section. The core problem, as indicated in chapter one, is that of a fallacious methodology, namely that of comparative mythology. The tendency, as the eminent Azraeliologist Leo Oppenheim once put it, to compile smoothly written systematizations decked out in a mass of all too ingenious comparisons and parallels obtained by zigzagging all over the globe and through the known history of man. This approach goes back to James Frazer and J.J. Baekhoven in the 19th century. In the 20th, the leading figure has been Carl Jung, with Marcel Eliade and Joseph Campbell following close behind. But as so many scholars have shown, the assumption of a mythic substrat or collective unconscious is just that, an assumption. Imported into history or anthropology, it amounts to no more than an attempt to force the record of the past into a framework previously decided upon. And this problem is endemic to all Jungian work. A much more realistic approach is the one captured by an old saw from Gestalt psychology. Our goal is not to make things happen, it is to see what actually does happen. The same cannot be said of the comparative mythology school, whose methodology is just the opposite. And then he refers to Jung's peculiar brand of psychohistorical misinformation.
If it all falls through, I'll move to Colorado. I'll sell my Eldorado. I'll have horses instead of cars. If it all falls through, I'll never go to cities. I'll sing with the coyotes on a rock beneath the stars. If it all falls through, I'll move out to Dakota. No one out there will know you. I could sing alone at bars. If it all falls through, I'll have 10 dogs and kitties. My old life in the cities will cry through you guitar. If you should leave me for someone fresh and new, if you should leave me, 'cause we've nothing left to do. If you were killed, I couldn't stand it here. I'd go be a cowgirl and still love you.
You know what a gestalt is?
I wouldn't want to have to define it. Do you want to?
Sure. So the word gestalt refers to a framework, a composite of something. And so from what I can remember of gestalt psychology, gestalt therapy from Fritz Perls, this is back in the 1960s, is to look at not just one thing like a symptom, but to look at the whole thing of the person in particular.
Right.
So I like that. Our goal is to not make things happen, is to see what actually does happen. However, what the implication here is that anything in mythology is just reaching back and it's taking creative license. That's how I read it.
Yeah.
Which, I'm not a Jung expert, but I can see the criticism as he continues here, pages 120 and 121. Did you have anything out there that stood out?
I guess I'm still synthesizing. I got something on page 122. Where are you about to cite?
Let's see. Well, he goes into a little bit of history about. Well, I'll just go on page 121. These are two things that stood
Well,
out.
hold on then, because I got something on 120.
Okay.
Any reconstruction of Mithraism is pure fantasy. However, this did not constitute an obstacle for Jung, for whom acts of imaginative reconstruction were the key to historical understanding. The image of a solar Aryan truth lying at the root of everything, access to which could only be had via occult initiation run by an enlightened elite, was irresistible to him. And this whole structure was in fact duplicated in Jungian analysis, with Jung serving as the high priest of his own mysteries.
So Mithraism is the Mithras cult from Roman times.
Yeah, with a ball, right?
Yep. So the enlightened elite, Brian Hayden.
Yeah.
Secret societies rear their ugly head.
Yeah.
Okay, so on page 121 in the second paragraph, he says, two things strike me as being very important here. The first is that although Jungianism is a patriarchal worldview, grounded as it is in the mysteries of an all-male cult, it fits very well with matriarchal mythology and the notion of a universal female deity. For although the Jungian Odyssey is a male one, the heroic journey, the man's search for his anima, the man's process of individuation, the would-be hero climbs the ladder of initiation only by virtue of a descent into the realm of the archetypical feminine. For Jung, the unconscious is female. And it is only through the temporary obliteration of consciousness, the dissolution of the ego into the absolute, that's a capital A, which is equal to the womb of the Great Mother, that the initiate gets his solar heroic wings. He undergoes psychic death and rebirth and becomes, in some sense, immortal. And the second point is, in both the mysteries and the Jungian world schema as well, hierarchy and elitism are central to the whole project.
And then, following on that same paragraph, where he's talking about the Jung cult, the collection of disciples initiates who would individuate so that they could become just like Jung. Jung's fantasy, writes Noel, was that of a hierarchical organization led by a priesthood that was privy to esoteric knowledge by rising through the ranks via initiation. But we should be clear by now that shamanic practice is, as Nicholas Thomas and Caroline Humphrey demonstrate, largely about personal and political power. Nor was Jung unaware of this. In 1928, he wrote that the vast majority of humankind needs authority, guidance, and law. And then, kind of started this whole paragraph below. Jung hopscotched from culture to prove his thesis regarding the existence of a collective unconscious. In his case, however, it was worse than mere anthropological naivete. He lied. So obsessed was he with this theory that he falsified the dates of his key case study, the so-called solar phallus man, this even in a televised interview on the BBC in 1959, and consistently maintained that the patients of his clinical studies had no knowledge of alchemy, Mithraism, or occult lore. Yet none of this was true. Jung's patients, including his British and American ones, were well educated and versed in mythologies of various sorts. Not only had such material been popular for decades, but many, if not most, of those patients had been involved in occult traditions and had even read Jung's works. Material on the collective unconscious often was gathered from the study of a single individual. In the case of Jung's famous essay, Individual Dream Symbolism in Relation to Alchemy, the subject was the physicist Wolfgang Pauli, a man of great erudition. In the case of his study in the process of individuation, the subject was the American Jungian Christine Mann, who had been a Swedenborgian and exposed to alchemical ideas long before she ever met Jung. All in all, says Noel, Jung's database was both biased and minuscule. Skipping over a bit, but of course there was nothing strange about this. Jung was critical of Freud's obsession, not his own. Actually, I'll go, but I should read all of that. It's quite a good paragraph. Commenting on Freud's fixation on repressed sexuality as the root of all human difficulties, Jung remarked how important it was for the researcher to have some ability for self-examination, to ask himself why he was obsessed with any given idea. Strangely enough, Jung exempted himself from this test. He never asked himself why the great mother, the collective unconscious, and the shotgun comparative method so overwhelmingly possessed his soul. But of course, there is nothing strange about this. Jung was critical of Freud's obsession, not his own. As Noel puts it, Jung was into mystery, not history, and history, he adds, is not the bread of the faithful. What we get instead is pseudo-history, built upon the shaky foundation of an alleged universal psyche. Nowhere is this configuration more evident than in the literature on an ancient matriarchy or goddess religion, to which I shall now turn.
Okay, so you mentioned earlier you had some thoughts about Jung.
About Jung?
Yes.
Oh, well, I mean, that's similar to what I was saying at the beginning, that how compatible Jung's worldview seems to be with the worldview of the elite, let's put it that way, just for simplicity's sake, or even the dominant paradigm that we're living in. It's almost as though we are living in an ideological mindset which is compatible with Jungianism, and in some ways, obviously not in all ways. And one of the ways that is quite obvious is the goddess cult, of how, you know, how widespread that's become via the New Age. I mean, it's throughout pop culture and other forms of culture. So, that seems to me a reason for skepticism in terms of Jung, if he was that influential and or that compatible with the dominant the ruling zeitgeist, let's say. And it suggests to me that hasn't been that therapeutic. I do think that Jung can be used very well, and I've quoted him, and I cowshed as a Jungian, and so I feel like I need to cut Jung down the middle somehow, and say good Jung, bad Jung, like a yin yang symbol. Not that that's good and evil. And of course, he's focusing on the negative. It's pretty hard for me to separate myself from a lot of this stuff, because it's so much of it's been internalized. So this, the whole thing of the journey of initiation of the hero and the going into the underworld to be reborn, it's pretty hard for me to see that objectively, because that's so much been formed, you know, my programming.
When did you first encounter him?
When I was 20. It was just after reading Castaneda, because after reading Castaneda, I was like, well, I gotta check out more stuff now, because, you know, my whole perception of what was possible and what was interesting transformed in a matter of weeks from reading Castaneda. And besides Crowley, Jung was one of the first places I ended up.
Now, did you encounter Jung himself, or did you go through, because I've known people who get to Jung through Joseph Campbell. That's your gateway drug, in a sense.
Yeah, no, I was never into Joseph Campbell. I did buy The Power of Myth for my mother, so I was certainly aware of him, but I never, he wasn't an influence on me directly. And I can't remember. I mean, I remember watching, I was wanting to say YouTube, but this was pre the internet, so I don't know how, but I remember watching Jung, an interview, and certainly by the time I was 24 in Morocco, I had the collected writings of Jung somehow I got hold of. In my 20s anyway, I got fairly deeply into Jung, and he became, I would say, one of half a dozen key influences on my thinking. But I wouldn't attribute to Jung my adoption of the solar hero archetypal journey to the underworld, that whole thing, because that's in Disney movies, that's just everywhere, that whole thing. It's that's why I say it's almost impossible to see it objectively, because it just feels like just reality to me.
I never read it, but did you read Jung's monograph on UFOs?
Yeah.
Did you read that before or after your Whitley Strieber
That's
period?
coming back to me now. Yeah, no, because that was one of the first ones I read. So I read The Divided. No, that's Radi Lang. Aeon. There were about three Jung books I read when I was 20, and they were all small ones. But anyway, so yeah, I did start reading him at that time, and Flying Saucers was, obviously one I was interested in.
So, what do you remember? I've never read it, so I can't speak authoritatively on it, but how would you view it from what you can remember in light of Whitley Strieber?
Oh, that book. Well, because I read it since, of course, and I read it while I was working on Prisoner Infinity. Well, it's not incompatible with Prisoner Infinity or with Whitley Strieber, if you know what I mean. Like, it's because he's, I mean, Jung's position on flying saucers initially was the archetypal imagery, but by the end, or even as a footnote to that book, he's like, well, actually, I have to admit, some of these things have detectable on radar, so we may be talking about something more than just tulpas of the collective unconscious. But most of that book is can be read and understood and applied in just in terms of archetypal imagery, and not, without addressing anything paranormal or parapolitical. So that's why I say it's compatible with Whitley Strieber's view, but it's also compatible with what I attempt with Prisoner Infinity, which is to see these experiences as partially dissociative projections and so on. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question or
I was
not.
just curious.
Yeah, well, that, I mean, that's not an outstanding Jung book. I have read Jung more recently while I was working on Prisoner Infinity, for example, and I definitely have found him to be very substantial. Like, when I read Jung, or the last time I read Jung, I got that feeling of this wisdom here. I certainly think the man had wisdom, and I don't think that he was deranged or sociopathic or anything, like I would say about Crowley. I just feel as though what Berman's pointing out, that he somehow got diverted or detoured or something, and maybe mistook like a whole list. I don't know how to put it, but I think he came up with his own version of reality, and he did create Jungism, and so at a certain point he stopped. Maybe he stopped exploring, and because he'd found a worldview that was sufficiently profound to satisfy him, while at the same time could keep him in a position of being the creator of it.
He stopped being a true seeker.
I'd be reluctant to put it that baldly, but yeah, I suppose that would be a fair summation of what I just said. It's kind of a delusion, and I wonder, I mean, if that is true, it may not be, of course, but around this thesis, and we haven't unpacked it yet, and I don't know if Berman does. But what he's saying there, the bit that you read, that for the solar phallic hero to become sovereign, or whatever we're going to call it, enlightened, he first has to re-enter into the mother, the unconsciousness, which is the great mother, the womb of the great mother, and be reborn through it. And so I just wonder if that isn't compatible with a maternal possession somehow, like allowing oneself to be repossessed by the mother's psyche, and archetypal possession, which Jung actually writes about. But that was the closest I came to a diagnosis of John DeRuyter, which was my case study for false enlightenment. What is this thing that isn't called false enlightenment? Because people don't talk about it, but I think it's a necessary term. There's something out there in the world that is a false form of enlightenment, where the person undergoes changes, transformations, and they do become greatly, they surpass ordinary human perception and consciousness, and they firmly believe that they've attained some ultimate state, but they haven't. I'm convinced there is this phenomenon, and that Derrida was certainly an example of it. And the best diagnosis I could come for it was archetypal possession, like allowing one's consciousness to be taken over by something outside of one, which could be the mother, or it could be an archetype, whatever they are, the collective consciousness. And that's consistent with the Prisoner Infinity Strieber diagnosis of a fragmentation of the psyche by which a progress part has access to transcendental wisdom and knowledge, but isn't fully embodied. Because so one doesn't become whole, but one does access higher knowledge and wisdom and even psychic powers and so on.
Yeah, one is possessed but not integrated.
Yeah.
Yeah. The danger there.
Yeah. So that would seem somehow to pertain to this whole thing around the mother and the goddess, and that there's a regression that's happening that gets mistaken for a progression. And possibly, although it's probably too soon to try and talk about this, but that this relates to this opening thesis that the mother who raises her child exclusively and so reinforces the idea of a mother identity then instills or implants the idea of an identity in the child as well.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean?
So just shifting gears, going back to the discussion we had about your niece. So your niece is a girl, obviously, but had you had a nephew been raised in the same respect, then I wonder if your nephew would have had the same kinds of difficulties as Berman lays out here about the separateness, the need to be heroic, to overcome the feminine, all of that stuff. Had a boy been raised in that same fashion? Yeah. You know, we don't have an example here where you can only speculate.
No, but I hear what you're saying, and I think it may be true, or almost certainly is true, that the neurotic side effects of having an overly present mother, let's say, or an over-involved mother / narcissistic, they're more obvious in a male, much more obvious in a male child than a female, because a female child can allow herself to be possessed by the mother's psyche and stay enmeshed in it and be empowered by that, whereas a male child will not be, will be disempowered, will be emasculated by it. He may compensate by becoming a supercharged master of the universe type, so, but that would be more obviously neurotic.
Mm-hmm. Unless, and I have to wonder if there was a strong father figure, because I've often thought about this, is when they talk about a strong father figure, what really does that mean? And something that is good for the child and is not a domineering father, an absent father, alcoholic, all that. You could have an absent father and a dysfunctional father. You could have also a domineering father who just is, in some cases, violent with the sons. I've known people where that's been the case. Or just somebody that rules the house with an iron fist, and even the wife is afraid of him. So then that fear is transferred to the child because everybody in the house fears the father.
Yeah.
So that's a perversion, I hesitate to use that term, a perversion of what a strong masculine presence is in the life of the family, particularly the children.
Yeah. What was your point?
I'm just riffing off of that. My father was not that. My father was always present. He lacked certain things, like he didn't prepare me for life in ways that I would have wanted. But when I look back on it, it's, you know, how could he have known, type of thing. He certainly wasn't like your father, who was just absent, or, you know, absent psychologically, not physically absent. And there are some kids I've known who the father was never around. Period.
Sure. Sure. It seems like that's still a spectrum, isn't it? Because you're talking about, well, a father who's absent versus, in your case, a father who's present but himself is absent certain qualities that you therefore can't emulate. And that, and it would seem that, and what we're talking around here is the parent as an example that we imitate and match as children, has to be to a degree the same sex parents. So for a boy, we need the father particularly to model us, model to us what being a man is, so that we can enter into that. So so yeah, I mean, any deficiencies will have an impact, and a completely absent one, yeah, leads just it's like a blank slate, isn't it? You just have to make it up.
Unfortunately, the male child, if there is no father, then takes on the qualities of the mother, which is not good for him.
No, it doesn't work at all. Well, I suppose you can have a homosexual child or a transgender now, and that would be a more literal imitation. But barring those cases, it doesn't work to imitate the mother. So then maybe this is where it comes in with the being heroic. The son is trying to be a man for the mother.
But is enmeshed in a dysfunctional relationship by being the surrogate husband.
Yeah, it can't ever work. It's Oedipal, isn't it? It's going to actually lead to self-destruction.
Yeah, Oedipal. That's not Jungian at all. Okay, well, pressing on page 123, the section of the myth of a goddess I did not have too much because he goes into much more historical, but a couple of things have popped up for me. So at the bottom of page 123, he says, well, first he talks about Jung's disciple, Erich Neumann, who was the star disciple.
Yeah.
So then towards the bottom, he says, the problem with this is that the historical record does not exist for the purpose of any particular school of psychological thought and cannot be rated arbitrarily for the latter's benefit. This mode of argumentation is a closed circle because the QED has already been drawn up. It is also the case that, disclaimers notwithstanding, if you are using historical materials, it is hard to avoid making assertions about real historical events. Thus, Neumann argues that the Venus figurines demonstrate that a goddess stood at the center of late Paleolithic and early Neolithic group life. That is, did so historically. But how can we know this? Certainly not through archetypical analysis, as we shall see below, more likely interpretations of the Venus figures exist than Jungian or religious ones. So just a criticism of the historical record of this Venus cult that is in Neolithic. Okay, so then he says below, thus it is undoubtedly true that male civilization has ignored its female side, has suffered as a result, and that recovering that side would be a salutary thing. I agree, I think we need to do it, but it is more a statement about the present than the past. There simply is no concrete evidence for continuous goddess worship or Paleolithic fertility cults. And while Neumann's plates are suggestive, they ultimately don't amount to a new historical record. So a comment here about those in the present looking at the past through current present lenses, and the caution against that.
Yeah, and the thought through the creation or the, at least the presentation of a false feminine, possibly, as in, well, we recognize there's an absence there, so let's find it, and if we can't find it, well, let's imagine that we found it. So then you get this projected image of a false feminine, which I think is, we can see that culturally for sure.
Right. And so, you know, cutting Neumann some slack, even Jung some slack, is that the records were not as good as they are now back then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when was Jung the most active? In the 20s, in the 30s? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would have to be, it was pre-World War II, and then Neumann would have been the 40s and the 50s. So there's been a lot better archaeological work done since then, from which Berman draws upon to discredit this.
Right.
Okay, so on page 125, Berman continues, this basic schema of a peace-loving goddess culture, matriarchal, if not actually matriarchal, destroyed by patriarchal invaders, is quite popular today and has been picked up by a number of writers. Okay, so in the previous paragraph, he talks about Maria Gimbutas, an anthropologist who's written things about the goddesses and then put forth this theory about In the previous paragraph, between 4500 and 2500 BC, Old Europe was invaded in three ways by Indo-European or Kurgan culture. Kurgan is a burial mound. As she calls it, Kurgan being the Russian word for pit, grave, or burial mound, which was patriarchal and warlike. The civilization of Old Europe was destroyed by the patriarchal element. The goddess was replaced by male deities, and Old Europe never recovered. Boy, isn't that a comment on today's feminist approach in things.
Sorry, what specifically?
So about the thesis that 4500 to 2500 BC, Old Europe was mostly matriarchal, but then there were these waves of the Indo-European invaders, and then that made it patriarchal. So ergo, this is the birth of the patriarchy that Europe has experienced since then, and which feminists are still complaining about now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so skipping ahead, again, a lot of this Berman devotes to just historical commentary. So at the bottom of page 131, he says, the problems with the goddess argument do not stop there, however. Even if we were to grant the existence of such a cult, where is the evidence that these old European cultures were peaceful and egalitarian? This used to be the view of Minoan civilization on Crete, for example, and a case can still be made for it being a more peaceful type of society than that of the Greek-speaking Mycenaeans on the mainland. But excavations in the 1970s have forced a reconsideration of this picture. Okay, so a comment on how do we know in the past that they were peaceful and egalitarian? We don't. Okay. So then in the next section, the Great Mother and the Aegean, again, more of historical commentary. So also in the next section, Mesopotamia, this is about the Sumerians, but he makes a point is that the Sumerians had male and female deities. And comment about Inanna. Okay, so then going to page 140. Religious experience in pre-axial civilizations. Okay. So he begins in the first paragraph. There is still the question of the nature of consciousness that prevailed as part of the religious configuration or sacred authority complex that was represented by festivals such as the sacred marriage rite or in similar rituals that occurred in, say, Egypt. What was the state of mind of the respective populations? Were the onlookers glazed out in a state of unitive trance? For the whole structure of these states was based on vertical, sacred, charismatic authority. That is how they functioned. But exactly what did that mean in terms of individual consciousness? Before we move on in time to the axial age and the mystery religions, we need to consider this question. So he continues, what seems to be the case for the Egyptians, writes the German scholar Erich Hornau, is that they evidently never experience a longing for union with the deity. They keep their distance from the gods. Unlike the Greeks, the Egyptians did not see their gods as inhabiting an immortal, transcendent world. For them, departure into the eternal world would be a departure into non-existence. While it is true that they believed in an afterlife, had an elaborate pantheon of gods and a system of magical practice that permeated nearly every facet of everyday life. And nevertheless the case that the Egyptians remained detached and balanced and avoid abrogating the self by surrendering to an ultimate, unlimited state of non-existence in which everything is possible. Several writers have stressed quite correctly that no trace of mysticism can be found in ancient Egypt. The Egyptians never succumbed to the temptation to find in the transcendence of the existent release for all imperfection, disillusion of the self, or immersion in and union with the universe. They remained active and often to us, startlingly matter of fact. Any sort of ecstasy appears quite alien to their attitudes.
Yeah, I have highlighted that also.
Okay. Any thoughts on that? It is an interesting point that the Egyptians, because I know from a long time ago when I started to get into them about mummification, and then in the tombs they left artifacts that the person would need to use in the next existence. However, the way that Berman is explaining it is that it's not this otherworldly realm. It's just almost seems to be a passing into another state. What you use in this life, you're going to use in the next life, whatever that is.
I'm just wondering how exactly it's not mysticism. Are you wondering that too?
I am, but I'm not an Egyptologist, so I can't comment in length about that. I have always wondered about that. You know, were the Egyptians really mystical in the Greek mystery cults sense? I just don't know.
No, me neither. I used to pretend I was an authority on the subject, but fortunately I got over that illusion. So yeah, I guess I won't comment.
On 141, I have, as for Mesopotamia, it was like Egypt, soaking in exorcism, sympathetic magic, and the like. But this does not tell us much about the real nature of religious life. Then continues, Mesopotamian religion, says Oppenheim, is not of the revealed variety. A private person could not approach a deity through dreams or visions, an axial development that began to occur in the form of oracular utterances, late in Mesopotamian history, and then only in peripheral areas outside Babylonia proper, possibly under Western influence. Manifestations of religious feelings, writes Oppenheim, as far as the common man is concerned, were ceremonial and formalized rather than intense and personal. So what stood out for me there is I remembered my own Catholic upbringing, where routinely people go to Mass on Saturdays or Sundays. And over time, I just started to see it as, now, why am I here? Because everybody is just reading the same thing again, and they're droning on through it. And then, you know, as my mother, perceptive person that she was, is, yeah, they're Catholics on Sunday, and then they're bastards for the rest of the week, type mm-hmm. of thing. So one wonders about, you know, the common people, is that they go to church and they trust the authority of the priest, and they are participating in the Mass, but are they really having, you were to scratch the person, are you really having any kind of communication with God or an angel or a sense of the divine there in the Mass? Or is it that you put all your stock in just the Mass and the formalized ritual itself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was watching a show yesterday. It was not a good show, the Medici's. And it had some Catholic rituals in there, and I was just observing, you know, all of the regalia of that, the robes and the jewels and the ornamentation and the particularly the hats, if you can even call them hats. I mean, what would you call those things that they put on their heads?
Mitres.
I was just thinking, what are they?
They're mitres, MITRE, that's the term.
Right, and all
Bishop's mitre.
Different shapes and sizes, yeah?
Yeah.
So,
right.
The bigger and heavier is, the higher the status.
But you know who the top dog is.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking, what kind of person would it take to actually be able and willing to wear one of those and not feel absolutely ridiculous? And ditto for the worshippers. How is it that seeing that doesn't create such cognitive dissonance, because it's so absurd to my eyes? And it always has been, but it was easier in the past just to dismiss them just as crazy religious people. But now I'm quite sympathetic with the Christian framework and et cetera, et cetera. But just looking at the surface of it, it just seems so nakedly, transparently farcical and false to me, as it always has, really, but in new ways now. And what is that? I mean, I'm just wondering if that relates to what you were questioning there. As in, people want to have, they want to have an experience of the numinous that is tangible, that isn't subtle. It's the opposite of subtle. Right? It actually has to be melodramatic.
For sure. I mean, particularly because I'm a classical music fan, all the masses that have been written, or sacred works from Bach and Handel and so on, going through that adds to the the religious experience, you could call it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember this was starting sometime when I was still in grade school and going to masses, the folk mass, where instead of the organist playing the hymns, you had a small ensemble with a guitar and tambourines.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was kind of like, yeah, about that, because he was raised more in the older style. He never was a fanatic Catholic in that way, but he's just kind of like, yeah, it's okay. I prefer the organ.
It wasn't performative enough. It wasn't.
Well, I'd say it wasn't performative, but maybe it didn't have the same kind of gravitas to it. I mean, you know, I listened to, for example, Beethoven's Missa Solemnis, which is one of the great choral works in Western classical music. And every time I listen to it, there, depending on where it's at, it kind of brings me to tears, because it's such a deeply moving work for me. And then you have a guitar and a tambourine, and you're like, how does that compare?
So certain melodies can only be performed with certain instruments, perhaps, and the enter the orchestra. But now I'm thinking as a counterpoint, not so much to what you described, but to what I was describing, which is the monks, Who dress in the robes? They all dress the same. There's nothing fancy going on, although they do have the pear abbot. The head monkey does look a bit fancy, but anyway. And then they go into the chapel and they chant. I'm not sure that when I was in the Benedictines, I mean when I was staying with them, I'm not even sure if there was an organ or anything. I mean, maybe there was an instrument, but it's possible also that it was just voices.
How old was the monastery that you stayed in?
It was a modern one. It's called Randall in France, Clermont-Ferrand. Unfortunately, it was a modern building. Not that I cared about those things back then, but now I do. But anyway, I mean, in terms of the austerity of the monk life is in direct contrast to the pomposity of the cardinals and co, and yet it's the same religion, more or less.
But the monks are initiates. There are
Well,
those secret societies again.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, perhaps, certainly that there's an overlap there. But so, I mean, the Catholic Church is a secret society too. If we define secret society not by it being secret as a society, but what goes on inside it being secret, safe to say that. Anyway, I'm certainly not suggesting that all monks, monk orders are benign and devout. Of course, they're made up of individuals. But just as a contrast of, seems to me that the pomp and the grandeur is more for the masses. I mean, because monks don't do stuff for the masses. You can visit the monastery, but they're not putting on a big show for in cathedrals. Whereas there's other stuff. From the Pope on down is for the masses, isn't it? Who do want, and this is very, it seems very in line with Haydn's description of secret societies and how they have these grand performances to spellbind the masses and recruit from them. That it all centers around having or creating an intense experience of. The numinous in quotes, because I would say it's probably not the numinous, my sense, if it requires lots of spectacle to have the experience,
A
then
counterfeit numinous.
it seems like it would be a counterfeit. That's how I feel at this point. I'm wondering where the gods come in as well, because and what you were writing about there about the different ways that the Egyptians and the Greeks related to the gods. Because I mean, I used to feel quite serious about the gods. I used to consider them to be real entities and that I'd have made contact with them, which including, sort of alien type beings, and there was quite a spectrum there, and certainly demonic ones, but also including actual gods, like I felt that I'd made contact with, well. Lucifer, for one. I guess I had to start at the bottom there. Maybe Horus, and so on. But these are things I used to genuinely believe, and now they just seem, I don't know, they just seem sort of irrelevant to me now.
Well, I wanted
What's
to
your
touch on, the point here about the masses versus initiates, we'll say. So if the masses are more than happy to participate in the grand pomp spectacle, they go sit in mass and then they go do their what they do during the week, as my mom says, be bastards for the rest of the week. But the monks have to be initiated in their collective in a building, in a location there. But in your case, when you were starting to get into the occult, you were more interested, shall we even say, primed to look towards that secret initiation type thing. Because correct me if I'm wrong, you were not raised religious. Your family was
No,
not religious.
the
But
opposite.
was there any kind of residual Anglican influence there, like, although you weren't raised influenced, like Christmas, did you go to an Anglican church for a service or things like that? And then what, and then because
No.
you did not, you weren't enmeshed in that whole pomp and circumstance, you just kind of went and it's like, I don't know what the big deal is. And I want, you see what I'm getting at, is kind of a certain priming, an anti-priming to the pomp and circumstances, more into the secret initiate type of thing. And that's, that maybe is part of your what led you down the path to get into the occult?
I think so. Certainly, there was no reverence in my family. There's opposite of reverence for religion and the royalty. So I was primed to be scornful of that as soon as I would lay eyes on it. Not specifically churches. We didn't go to churches, but I didn't have disregard for churches, the beautiful buildings and whatnot. But what went on in them was considered, yes, just for the masses, for the stupid people, and so it would seem as though that would be compatible, consistent with a later drive to, while still rejecting religion, to have access to the mysteries from a more elitist perspective. I would say so, but the Christian mindset, the iconography, what have you, somehow installed itself in me. It became unmistakable, in my 20s, because although I was taking the route of the occultist self-initiate, self-made shaman, it was centering around Christian religious ideology. Like, I believed in the apocalypse, I believed I was one of Christ's apostles, reincarnated, St. Peter even, etc., etc. So all that stuff was not just indispensable, it was central to my self-generated myth. I put the scare quotes there, because obviously it wasn't. So it was like what happened there? I was rejecting all the outer trappings, but the inner core of it was what I wanted to have access to, but also it had accessed me in some way.
What comes to mind is, it's a comment, but there's a joke underneath it, is that the best Catholics are converts.
Yeah.
which from what I understand, my grandmother on my dad's side was a convert, Catholic.
Mm.
She was originally raised Protestant. I don't know if she was practicing or not. I never knew her that well. But she was a convert, and that's how they ended up with 7 kids. That's the side joke.
Mm-hmm.
That's mostly from my mom. You know, she was the one that made that comment. Yeah, the best Catholics are converts.
Because they're more fanatical.
Yes. Whereas those of us who were raised in, you're just kind of like, yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever. You're swimming in it from day one. You have no choice. Now, later on, you might come to reject it, particularly if it's if it's harmful to you. Now, in the case of the Catholics, if you were an altar boy and had been abused by a priest, now that's certainly come up more in the past 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
But getting back to the text.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in 141, the second paragraph, he says, "The issue of the ceremony and formal is, I think, the key to this, and it meshes well with Julian James's notion of bicamerality. People on automatic pilot, as it were. Not that there was no self-conscious awareness in Egypt or Mesopotamia. Whoever called the text that has Inanna calling out to Dumuzi, plow my vulva," this is in the previous section, "can hardly have been living in an unconscious fog, but the general atmosphere of these civilizations is one in which the individual is submerged in a larger whole. We do not have the individual autonomy syndrome of hunter-gatherers discussed in Chapter 2, or the training for innovative thinking mentioned in Chapter 3. This is not unitive trance practice, but rather a kind of group mind that serves as the psychic glue of these civilizations. This is what made the later change in Greek and Hebrew cultures so dramatic, because they broke with this totality of the sacred authority complex, which they found suffocating. At least in the Jewish case, we have a putatively pastoral or nomadic people effectively saying, we're out of here. The Exodus was not merely a departure from the Nile Valley. It was also a rejection of the ceremonial, formalized, sedentary way of life. We were slaves to Pharaoh in the land of Egypt, Jews still say every year at the Passover Seder. Slaves to the world of myth, in other words, a bicameral group mind. Thanks but no thanks, the Hebrews declared. You can keep your pantheon. We'll bake some matzo and hit the road."
Mm-hmm.
So the first emergence of a pastoral or nomadic people.
So, but wasn't that somewhat congruent with the emergence of patriarchy? I mean, the Jews were certainly the patriarchs, so they're known as the patriarch Abraham on down, and the Egyptian religion, if we're going to call it that at all, was centered around the Nile and the goddess as much as, if not more than, the god, I would think, Isis. So, might there not be some correlation there? From goddess to god worship.
Right, a good point. From matriarchal to patriarchal. And maybe there's an inference here that patriarchal is somewhat wrapped up in the nomadic lifestyle, which he starts to get to in the next chapter.
Okay.
Okay. So on page 142, the section of the Axial Age, Berman says the term Axial Age was coined by the Swiss German philosopher Karl Jaspers years ago to denote the period and events of the first millennium BC. During this time, a number of civilizations arose or were transformed along the lines of a sharp vertical split between heaven and earth, what the Israeli sociologist S.N. Eisenstadt calls the transcendental and mundane orders. This included ancient Israel, Greece, Iran, China, and the cultures of Hinduism and Buddhism. If we extend this backward in time to include the emergence of the mystery cults and the breakdown of bicamerality, and forward in time to include Islam, the Axial Age is really something like 1800 BC to 700 AD, about 2500 years. Yet the most turbulent period, as Jasper said, does remain the 1000 years preceding the birth of Christ. He continues. The idea then is that of the ordinary or secular world down here and a perfect or divine world up there. As this is vertical sacrality, the trademark of the Neolithic, it would seem that nothing new is really going on. This is the sacred authority complex of Egypt, Mesopotamia, and the early other states and chiefdoms, no? Well, say Jaspers, Eisenstadt, and other axial scholars, not quite. In the pre-axial civilizations, they maintain, the two orders of the mundane and the supernatural are homologous. That is to say, the higher world is structured symbolically along the same lines as the lower one. The two realms are parallel and even embedded in one. Thus, the gods in these cultures quarrel, fight, experience jealousy, deceive each other, go hungry, and even die, as we do here on Earth. The powers of the gods were limited. In Egypt, Osiris was slain, and Ra grew decrepit. He was even tormented by a snake bite. In the Axial civilization, something else has happened. If nothing else, this upper world has become transcendent. It is the realm of eternity, and the gods live forever. So that's the fundamental shift that happened at the Axial Age.
So it's like a split, would you say, between heaven and earth?
Split between heaven and earth, but particularly in Greek mythology, the gods are like humans and they exist on Mount Olympus, which really, when you think about it, is not so much of a transcendental realm. It's just here on earth at a much higher plane. Higher level, higher elevation.
So the gods were less transcendent, essentially. They were closer to kind of elevated versions of ourselves.
Yes, that's how I've always read it. And the myths themselves are just stories of, you know, for example, Zeus, who was the philanderer, making his way.
Because
And
they weren't virtuous either, particularly the gods in
no,
that model. They were
no,
powerful, but not necessarily virtuous.
no. Some were more virtuous than others. Zeus certainly was not, but yet Zeus was the life giver too. Okay, so in the next paragraph, Berman says the focus was on physical continuity into the next world, which is why, for example, Egyptians embalmed the dead and buried them with food, especially bread and beer, toilet articles, and weapons. In the mystery cults of ancient Greece or the oracular prophecy of late Mesopotamia, something else is going on. Continuity can and should occur, but it is now based on the reconstruction of the personality. We are at the age of Gnosticism here. The mundane world is regarded as inferior, and human beings, via certain kinds of occult practices, can become like gods. And by the process of such reconstruction, the mundane world could perhaps be remade on the basis of the transcendental one. This shows up in Plato and in Jung and is the ascent tradition of later agricultural civilization. The goddess is not merely a ritual or ceremonial figure anymore. She is Diotima in Plato's dialogues, or the great mother archetype, into which consciousness is dissolved, and with whom fusion of psyche and divine is made possible.
So in the Christian resurrection, or at least some interpretations of that as a literal thing, there's no afterlife that is not physical.
Right, the resurrection of the body
is actually physical, and that in between now and Judgment Day, we're just in some limbo waiting to be resurrected physically. So yeah, the only afterlife is a continuation of this life, just with a, you know, with a space in between.
Right. But interestingly enough, have you read Dante?
No.
So Dante, I'd say, is a good case example of where, you know, the Divine Comedy is in three parts: Inferno, or hell, purgatory, and paradise. So we know what hell is. This is where Dante and Virgil, they begin their journey. But when they get to purgatory, purgatory is a mountain at the opposite end of hell. Hell is within the earth. Purgatory is this mountain that's at the opposite end. And the souls have to ascend purgatory. And this is, you know, at the time that Dante wrote this was a well-established tradition in Christianity, although it was not an original Christianity, that you have to purge yourself, hence the name purgatory, to get to, at the top of the mountain is the Garden of Eden. And then you go into paradise, which is heaven, the realm of the virtuous and the realm of the supreme, getting closer and closer to the Godhead, cherubim and all that. But I always thought the interesting thing reading that is, you know, purgatory is here on earth, but purgatory is a collection of souls, and then one wonders if the soul is still embodied. And then with the whole resurrection of the body, well, if you said that somebody's gone to heaven but their body is still here, then why would the body need to be resurrected if they're already in heaven, type of thing?
Yeah.
This doesn't seem to add up.
Well, a lot of Christian things don't seem to add up, of course. And maybe all these subjects don't. What came to mind was the kingdom of heaven is within, which is indicating it's not some place, it's not far away, on the contrary, it's inside us, which could even be, mean inside the body. So then I was wondering, well, is heaven, because I know that hell in the Bible isn't really very present. I mean, Sheol is the grave. But in terms of hell in this more Dantean sense, I'm not sure if it's in the Bible much, and is maybe that's true of heaven too. I don't know, because we don't have the Hebrew versions to refer to, most of us.
Yeah, hell is not mentioned in the Bible that much. It came later. Mm-hmm. Now, at the time that Dante was writing, this is the 14th century, so hell was well established, and this is, you know, it's a poem that describes, you know, he's taking most everybody that he mentions within the Divine Comedy is either a historical figure from the past. For example, Aristotle and Cicero and the ancients are in limbo in hell, which is the first circle, because they did not accept Christ. They were not Christians, but yet they were virtuous enough to not to be plunged into the depths of hell.
Yeah.
But many of the figures are some contemporaries. Know Florentines, or, you know, Muhammad is in hell, for example, and there's a famous fresco in one of the Italian churches that the Muslims were up in arms about some years ago.
I'm sure.
That was just taken as a given. You know, Muhammad is in hell. Muhammad is the devil, if not the devil, at least in service to the devil, type thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but what about heaven in the Bible?
Well, heaven's not very well outlined either. The kingdom of heaven. What does that mean? Heaven is on earth. Heaven it was in. Now, in some of the other books, the apocryphal, well, apart from the apocryphal, like the Gospel of Thomas and all that, you know, Elaine Pagels is a religious scholar who's spent a lot of effort investigating this. You mentioned some things that are almost Gnostic-like. Those types of gospels. Jesus is speaking in a certain way that the Gnostics would, and you know, also the thing that sticks out is about Gnosticism, that Berman mentions here. The mundane world is regarded as inferior, and human beings via certain kinds of occult practices can become like gods.
Well, I mean, the obvious way that the mundane world is inferior, in quotes, is it's in time. It's nested in time, and everything dies and then rots, which would seem to be not a quality we would hope to encounter in heaven, or indeed post-resurrection. I mean, there wouldn't be much point in being resurrected in the body if you're just going to die and rot again, right? So there is a reason. It's easy to see where the Gnostic mindset would come from, possibly. Although, I think there is a counterpoint to this, which is, would our experience of the body, and maybe this is the horizontal view, be identified with death or rot, the death of the body per se, if we didn't have this mind identity thing filtering the experience of the body through it, as compared to the body just being nested in nature, which is cyclical and constantly resurrecting. So the body itself, well, not this particular body, but the body as a cell in the body of the earth, which is a cell in the body of the universe, is constantly resurrecting.
But I still go back to my question of, or where it doesn't add up is, you know, even if you took the dualistic view, is that there's a mind or soul that resides in the body, and the body is corruptible, it does not survive. And then the mind or soul ascends to the heaven or another otherworldly realm. Why still speak of the resurrection of the body? Why would you even need it afterwards? You know, the body was your prison. This came later. This is not so specific in the Bible.
Yeah.
And even before Gnosticism, you know, just the corruptibility of the body. And, you know, again, why would you need it? And why even speak of the resurrection of the body?
Right.
That's where it becomes confusing, at least to me, when I pondered it. But well, you know, for the average person, you're just like, oh yeah, resurrection of the body.
Well, maybe it's like a teddy bear for the mind and the transitional object, because we're in this liminal space, or this with the imago, you know, the between the caterpillar and the butterfly, anyway, the chrysalis phase. So we're not still cognizant of the experience of the body, the natural experience of the body of being continuous with nature, but nor are we, you know, in the transcendental eternal space. We're in this in-between space. So then we need these stories that somehow bridge the gap. And the resurrection of the body seems to me it's an interesting framework, because it is positing the eternal, but within the physical, within the temporal. And it's one of the least, like, heaven is still trendy, you know. Heaven is still, you know, you've even got neuroscientists writing about heaven these days. Well, a couple of the books recently, they've self-debunked, haven't they? They said we made it up. But I'm not sure, but the one written by a neuroscientist, I think, is still kosher. But anyway, the concept of heaven is really central to our worldview, even if we're not Christian, probably, and of an afterlife. The concept of a resurrection of the body is very unpopular, isn't it? Because it seems like you can't really make sense of it. But I wonder if it isn't closer to something true, which I can't particularly articulate, but that consciousness, like if our soul nature is transcendent, in the sense it transcends not the body per se, but the identity, as in our separate sense of self. So as we experience our souls, we experience ourselves as part of a getting a bit Jungian here, but of a collective soul of humanity, just say. And that relates to the Christian incarnation, as in consciousness incarnating in a human being, that's God actually experiencing God himself as a human being. Potentially we can all experience this, because we're all part of the body of Christ. That experience of our nature as eternal consciousness is only really possible through having a body, through being in a body. Therefore, the only kind of eternal existence is bodily. Because once we're disembodied, we're outside of any kind of self-awareness anyway.
Right. Well, just quickly before I continue the text, with Aristotle, what in Greek is called the psyche, but then that was translated into Latin as the anima, which is the animating force. You know, it's the life force that is part of the body, but it perishes with the body. The individual life force, not the collective life force, would continue on. So Aristotle spoke of, and the anima is translated as on the soul sometimes, but you have to be careful with that because somebody might read that and have the Christian, it's freighted with the Christian interpretation of there. But soul, the anima, or the psyche is just the life force that is present within a body, not just the human animal, but also a dog or a cat, so on. Anything that is animated that appears to have this life force, that's what the anima is. And it wasn't until later on, I believe one of the first appearances in Greek about the separation of the soul, an incorporeal soul in the body, is in Pythagoras, and that predates Plato. Plato talks about it a lot, but Aristotle doesn't.
Right. Okay. That's your area of expertise.
Yeah. However, you know, the funny thing is that going into the Middle Ages, Aristotle was elevated as the philosopher, capital P, mainly for the logic, and Plato was kind of forgotten until the sack of Constantinople, when plenty of Greeks, because the manuscripts were still in Greek and they made their way to Western Europe. And then in the Renaissance, there was a reappreciation of Plato, particularly among mystics, Neoplatonics, like Marsilio Ficino and all that.
We'll be right back.
right, so going to the next page, page 144, or rather starting at the bottom of page 143, he says, it is only with the clear breakdown of bicamerality well into the Axial Age that we have an unequivocal evidence of organized cult practice of an ecstatic nature. Thus, by the 7th century BC, we have female prophets, or ragintus, literally those who cry out, channeling the voice of the goddess Ishtar, a development that had no place in traditional Mesopotamian life. Linked to the search for salvation, moreover, was the drive for utopia. The two are part of the same impulse. As a result, the axial civilizations developed the notion of an event, that, for example, the coming of the Messiah, that would come along and close the gap between the mundane and the transcendent once and for all. In effect, the mundane order will be destroyed, a notion not present in pre-axial civilizations. All of this millenarianism had a lot of proselytizing zeal attached to it, and along with this, an intolerance for other modes of salvation. This intolerance was rooted in the uncertainties generated by the two worlds split itself. So you get the emergence of orthodoxies, which in turn generate challenges to themselves, and the challengers are typically as intolerant as the establishment. Axial civilizations share a totalistic view of change. There is always the attempt to remake the world according to the prevailing transcendent vision. For Eisenstadt, then, the Axial Age marks the birth of ideology. Any comments on that?
No. Let's push on.
Okay. So the next question is the mystery, or next section is the mystery cults.
Okay.
Okay. Did you have anything in that?
No, not yet. Well, until page 46.
46, okay. That's where I started. Go ahead.
Is that? So what's that? Well, I just marked a little passage on 46. Much the same thing happened to the Isis cult of Egypt. Isis was a very old goddess. It's obviously, I'm not even sure why I marked that. And it gets into the Eleusinian mysteries. So what have you got on that page?
So the paragraph that begins, the timing of all this, generally from the 7th century BC on, is significant, for it corresponds to Julian James's notion of the breakdown of bicamerality and to Bruno Snell's assertion in The Discovery of Mind of the discovery of the individual around this time.
Right, and then on page 147... I marked this passage about the nature of the initiation process. Well, that's because that part is in 16 Maps of Hell, so I don't really need to quote it here, but it's about the initiates who castrated themselves. Their genitals and clothing were then carried into the phanum or inner shrine, also called the bridal chamber of Cybele or Cybele. After that, the galley, the self-castrated, wore women's clothing, wandering the countryside, performing ecstatic dances and breaking into prophecy. To be filled with the Great Mother, to be possessed by her, was the only form of life they desired.
Wow, there's a lot in there.
Yeah, well, it's certainly an extreme case of of maternal possession, isn't it? Well, it literally says, possessed by the Great Mother, and they're turning themselves into women. Hard to see that as any kind of embodiment of divine principles.
Right, it's almost a rejection of their maleness.
Well,
you imagine that? Can you imagine that your genitals are being carried into the inner sanctum?
It's hard to imagine feeling good about it, isn't it? Like, this is it. Finally, I have attained. And it definitely would suggest, well, more than suggest, that it's a rejection of the body, of the physical. And a ceremony, making a ceremony out of rejecting the physical, as a way to assert one's divineness.
So I wonder how this applies to those who go for sex change operations.
Well, yes, of course, that's the current question, isn't it? I mean, and the deification of that identification today. I mean, the trans, the way it's raised up as being the pinnacle of something that must be protected and venerated.
Well, sometimes I have to wonder, how is it that somebody could somebody who is born male, but they say that they identify as female. And I kind of make a distinction between those who, what's fashionable, yes, I don't hesitate to use that term, fashionable to say that you're transgendered because you don't like the gender, not the sex, because sex is distinct from gender. You don't like your gender and you want to identify with another one, particularly girls to boys, because they feel that boys are more stable, relatively speaking, and they have more of a, curiously and contradictorily enough, they have more power in the world, so the girls think. So that's why they want to identify as boys, even though they're physically girls, until maybe at some point they grow out of it. But then later on, you might have adults, a middle-aged adult, like a man who wants to have a sex change because he truly wants to become a woman. And he identified with being female all of his life. And I've never had those feelings or those inclinations. So sometimes I find that puzzling, where what really goes on in the person that really goes through with it and has a sex change operation, changes their name, all of that stuff.
Yeah, well, I imagine that's true of most people, including the people that it's happening to, but of course there's a cultural drive now to reify it and validate it and not question it, and even there's, there are laws prohibiting questioning it. Even or maybe especially at the level you're talking about, well, what's going on? Can we understand this? Which is that to me is more mystifying even than what's going on internally for a person there. The fact that the culture has validated this to the point that we're being encouraged to accept it unquestioningly as something normal. That to me is more mysterious than the first mystery, and it certainly can distract from it. To me, the first thing well, I just said it isn't as mysterious. I tend to say it isn't that mysterious, but it's probably not true. But I certainly think it relates directly to what we're talking about here in terms of over-identification with the mother. Like, I think the if we're going to call it pathology, or the trend that Berman's talking about in this chapter, I think has reached critical mass in our culture today, and that transgender is definitely one of the flags signaling that. That, and of course, it does go the other way, as you pointed out, as women identifying with being men, so it's not as cut and dried as we might like. It does seem as though it began primarily as men wanting to be women, and certainly the figures that are rarefied and making the cover of magazines currently have all been men to women transsexuals, and it is transsexual. That's the paradoxical irony of it, that the people who say that they don't like their gender, they're not trying to change their gender, they're trying to change their sex, because anyone can change their gender. That's been acceptable for 50 years or something. You just wear men's clothes, or it's harder for a man to wear women's clothes, that's true, but still he can be gay, right? So and anyway, well, the gender thing has been more political, hasn't it? As in, it's women who don't want to be restricted to female gender definitions. That hasn't been so obvious for men. But either way you slice it, one can just shirk one's gender theoretically, without doing anything, and changing one's sex is the opposite. One's actually reinforcing one's gender then.
Have you ever known anyone had a sex change operation?
Yes, is the short answer. I haven't. It's never been someone that I knew already, and then they. I've not had that experience, but I've met. Well, there was one particular person that I had a correspondence with for quite a period, who was already half transitioned.
What did they give as the justification? The standard, I felt I identified more as the opposite sex, and that's why I went in the direction.
No, that they were. I don't know if they're still around. I haven't been able to find them. Amy George was her name, his her name when I met him, her. It was very alchemical. They had a very, you might even say Jungian, but certainly a transcendental, spiritualized thing, that they were integrating the two halves, and the alchemical wedding was happening in their own soul and body, and The theory of it was all stuff I was familiar with and agreed with. What I didn't agree with was that they were literalizing it, and I found that quite disturbing, particularly as they were saying, oh, you're like me and you're going to want to go this way too. I was thinking, oh my God, really, am I going to want to cut my balls and penis off? It's hard to imagine, but I've had a pretty rocky ride so far. So I found their understanding compelling enough that it did make me question at that time. But this was 12 years ago, and so it was before the thing went critical mass.
So, is this person trying to become a hermaphrodite,
They
in a
were a
sense?
hermaphrodite, I guess, as that they had both male and female body parts, I believe, and I think
Oh,
they
so
were.
they were one, actually one.
No, I mean they had made themselves into one. They weren't
Okay.
born as one.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's not the standard term anymore, I don't think. There's another one versus hermaphrodite.
Right. I don't
Right.
know.
Yeah. It's a gauche term, from what I understand. But androgynous is not, as far as I know.
Well, I've long identified as androgynous ever since I was into David Bowie. I mean, much less so now, as I've got the beard and the Canadian get-up and so on. But certainly in my youth, I was felt quite androgynous.
I always found that interesting. Because we're close to the same age, how in the 80s that was the thing for certain artists becoming
Yeah.
androgynous. You mentioned David Bowie, but he started that in the 70s. That was some
Yeah.
years before. I guess he set the trend, maybe.
He pretty much did,
Yeah. Okay, so anything on 147?
yeah. 147, no.
Okay, so what did I have? Okay, so at the very bottom of 147, Berman says, according to Walter Burkert, who authored Ancient Mystery Cults, the mysteries offered a chance to escape from a barren and predictable world, to create a sense of meaning and a banal life by means of an experience of a great rhythm in which the individual psyche could be integrated through a large sympathetic event. No doubt. But what if life were not barren and banal? What if the environment were not experienced as adverse? What if, in short, one were a hunter-gatherer? Would one then be impelled to die, to be reborn, become a hero? The axial age is a desperate one, and we are effectively still living within it. Ascent is a recent phenomenon. For the most part, it is rooted in alienation and not finding this world is enough. In their article, Deprogramming, Thomas Robbins and Dick Anthony argue that spiritual ecstasy is hostile to mankind's deepest aspirations. This is an intriguing statement, sure to send many spiritual devotees into a fury of ecstatic rage. The interesting thing here is that it is untrue, in the sense that if your life is barren, perhaps a good dose of God realization is just what you need to glimpse the larger possibilities. To know the possibilities of a boundary loss can be a good thing. Fusion does contain a certain type of truth, in that the primordial connection to the mother is part of our biological heritage. But the statement is true in that human life should not be barren, and if it is, something has seriously gone awry. And if we get hooked on ecstasy and heroic rebirth, there is the likelihood that we shall never get down to the deeper layer of paradox. As I said earlier, it becomes a way of getting trapped in a worldview, and thus ultimately prevents us from finding the world.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, I think.
So I have to ask about what pops to mind here is psychedelics and substances. To On the one hand, you could say to numb, just zone out. But in another sense, particularly in the case of psychedelics, to really, I mean, it's really trying to achieve that ascent experience. So the people believe.
Yeah, whereas I would say I'm related to his point, and you could say it's about a lot of other things, occultism, maybe religion and psychotherapy, maybe just about everything that is a potentially positive path. That it's a bit of a mistaking the finger for the moon, perhaps, is the problem, that with psychedelics, that, and this is in Castaneda, he only gives Carlos Castaneda psychedelics or those plants because he's stupid, that Castaneda needs a shock to his system whereby he will let go of his firm attachment to his interpretation of reality. He needs to be shaken loose, his assemblage point. So then it's not that the psychedelics actually take us into some higher transcendental realm or even let us see anything that's transcendental, but they shake our fixed interpretation of reality in such a way that it'll be looser after that and we'll be more open to perceiving other things that we weren't able to perceive. And I think that that's true of occultism and even psychotherapy. Like, because we're so stuck and entrenched in a particular way of living and a way of perceiving, it often does require some sort of jolt or some kind of method that is potentially harmful, but that measured at the right dose homeopathically will, you know, push us out of the groove that we're stuck in, and then at least then our options open up. But if we mistake, it's like getting addicted to a drug. It's that analogy, isn't it? If we mistake the the journey for the destination, if we think that it's just a tool that's enabled us to see possibilities, but if we think that actually the one possibility that tool has allowed us to see is the goal, rather than simply, oh, now we've been able to see that there's more to our experience than we realized, if we make that mistake, then we keep going back to the same method or the same drug and using it again and again, when actually it may have already served its purpose. And if we keep using it to try and get higher and higher or further and further, it'll have the opposite effect. We'll actually just keep going round and round, and we'll be reinforcing. It's actually making me think of this transgender thing again, that having a sense of not identifying with the gender and even perhaps to a degree not identifying with one's sex or not over-identifying could be very healthy. But if that sense of uncertainty just leads into a re-identification with the opposite, then we're just as stuck. In a sense, we're more stuck because we've gone invested in surgery or chemicals or drugs or whatever. And I've actually missed the real opening, which is, well, you know, we're not, you know, we don't have to be defined by the things that define us. So, I think that's what that passage is addressing, that there are methods and things that might be necessary, but only as a preliminary to a subtler, gentler kind of approach.
I wanted to bring John Michael Greer into this for a minute. Have you read any of his occult books?
No, I've only read his UFO book.
Okay. I haven't read through them extensively, and he's written a lot. That's what his bag is. But I've certainly heard enough in his talks where he's defined the occult as a perception shift. Practices around a perception shift, which, you know, again, I'm filling in the gaps here because I'm not intimately familiar with it. Is that when you're reading a spell, for example, you're not really taking it that literally? It's part of the process, or maybe even you could say it's a ceremony to affect a perception shift or a mental shift.
Mm-hmm.
That's really all it is fundamentally. At least that's the way I read him, is how he defines the occult versus your path that you took down the occult, which was more about personal power.
Well, it wasn't incompatible. I mean, I would have agreed back then that it was all about a perception shift. So, I mean, why does John Michael Greer keep doing it if it's just about a perception shift? Why does he have to keep shifting his perception?
Good question.
I mean, I think that is consistent, what Greer's saying, with, I mean, even what Crowley would have said. So I'm not sure that the bid for power, and certainly in my own experience, is something that is generally consciously embarked on. I think it's just as likely to be unconscious. And so, you know, why the need for a perception shift? Well, there's two obvious reasons that come to mind. One is uncomfortable in one's present situation and feels that one needs to get out of it, which can definitely be healthy, and there's no doubt that there are unhealthy situations to get out of. And then the other, which isn't incompatible, is that we want more power. And that one is usually less conscious. In fact, they're both often less conscious, because often it's just, well, I suppose everyone would say that they want to improve their life in some way, but they might not admit that they're trying to get out of a difficult situation. Anyway, so I might have interrupted you before you...
It's an interesting point. Yeah, it's an interesting question. Why does it continue to do it if it's a perception shift? I was just approaching it from, you know, reading his definitions of the occult actually made a little bit more sense to me than it would have reading Crowley, which I've tried to do before and I never could really get into that. But I see your point is that, yeah, that's a form of perception shift. But what else is going on underneath in Crowley's case that makes it unsavory?
And I would wonder also, if one is reading spells and whatnot, while at the same time knowing that the spells don't really mean anything, and so, yeah, you're not taking them too seriously, but they're allowing the perception shift. Well, for me, it would feel as though that would create a bit of a split or perpetuate a schism in myself, a bit like these funny hats that the cardinals are wearing. Like, if I have to keep telling myself to believe something or do something that I didn't believe in because I wanted a shift... I feel as though I would be kind of reinforcing a delusion for myself.
You'd feel inauthentic.
Well, I would definitely feel inauthentic. Anyway, maybe I don't know if this is a side point of its central. What was the larger topic that we were on? Oh, what Berman was saying about the unitive trance states being possibly necessary, but also a trap. So, I mean, I wonder if it relates in some way to the psychotherapeutic method, which is we do need to go back to formative experiences in some sense. We do need to go back to deeper layers of, or into deeper layers of the unconscious in order to get free of their hold over us. But if at a certain point, if we just keep going and keep going, and this is maybe the hero, the supposed individuatory journey, that you've just got to keep going down in order to be reborn. I'm not sure. But we may end up just spinning our wheels, because at a certain point, the Castaneda thing was you have to recapitulate every single thought you've ever had. Clearly a person would go insane attempting to accomplish that, and it couldn't be done within the time frame we've got. So there's got to be a point at which you just let go and say, okay, I've done the heavy lifting I can do now, and now I better just get chopping wood and carrying water, because otherwise I won't have any tea tonight.
Yeah. And you definitely don't want to regress when you do your spade work to go back. That's the danger.
Well, I think that is maybe the danger he's underscoring there with the Great Mother, that one has to go back to the Great Mother because she has some of our life force that she's captured. This is my experience. But not to be re-immersed in her womb. One is going there to just to... because one is attached already, so one's already been pulled back. So one allows oneself to be pulled back to get loose, and then move on. Whereas the idea of going back to re-immerse in the womb and somehow be reborn through it, don't know. I mean, I had this idea. I also had this idea that I was going to get reborn through a woman, you know, as in not my mother, but the woman that I would marry. And my wife disabused me of that, you know, as persistently and as she could, and I think successfully in the end. Not to say I still don't like immersing myself in her body. I do, but I don't have this idea that somehow I'm going to become well, I probably still do have this idea, but it's getting reduced, this idea that I can only become fully whole or fully a man through my wife's body. I mean, I'm becoming aware as I'm speaking, I still have this idea that for me to reclaim the life force and be a fully solar masculine hero, I need to be able to maintain an erection for 4 hours, kind of thing, you know, be a super lover. I still have that idea, but I don't believe it, not really. I just recognize there's something about the experience of being sexual that does make me feel more embodied, but I know that that's a trap too, that it can't be that simple and cut and dried.
All right, getting to the last section, page 148. So this is the axial way of life.
Yeah.
Okay, so Berman begins, he says, with the rise of the mystery cults and the institutionalization of unitive trance, the sacred authority complex is taken to its apogee. Apparently, it took a higher degree of sedentism and urbanization to do this. Though, like James and Eisenstadt, I have no clear answer as to why such a profound shift occurred. But its preparation goes back, in any case, to the changes of the early Neolithic. Women's political and economic power declines. Birth spacing decreases. Mothering, once a part of female life, now becomes the focus of that life. Multiple mothering and diffuse energy patterns are weakened, and the child basks in the hallowed presence of the mother's aura and attention. If it is a male child, he will now get the message that this job is, in some way, to serve his mother and save her, to give her, through heroic acts, the life she can lead only vicariously. He will search for charismatic energy everywhere, saying, this is real. He will, in Mesopotamia, worship Inanna, goddess of sexual love and war combined. War, romantic love, the sacred authority complex, and finally unitive trance will all go together, make sense on an energetic level. He will be steep gradient, in Philip Slater's characterization, and vertical power structures will come naturally to him. The mythic properties of the mother and the nursery that Dinnerstein talks about will, not coincidentally, show up in his goddesses and their mythologies of sexualized mother-son relationships. On a visceral level, goddess cults and initiation rites will ring true for him. At one extreme, literally then and symbolically now, he will castrate himself, wear women's clothing, dissolve into the Great Mother. At the other extreme, he will become a conqueror of men and his own feminine impulses. He will enjoy war and the energetic rush it provides. War, sacrifice, death, charisma, heroism, love, and authority in legends. All of this will, strangely, be what life is about. He will extol war, the warrior archetype. He will love women, but he will resent them as well. He will, as Paul Shepherd says, remain a permanent adolescent and feel, in some level, brittle, perhaps even a bit haunted.
And then I also mark the next paragraph. So this is the link to our previous chapter. The force of the Great Mother image derives from unconscious memories in infancy. This is what makes mothering and issues of gender equality so significant for culture at large. A possessive goddess is quite congruent with an infantile society, and the link with agriculture is, as noted, one of obedience as a lifestyle. Julian James had to posit auditory hallucinations as the controlling agent here, but in fact nothing so exotic is required. If you're trained from infancy into the sacred authority complex, you'll do what you're told. This is very congruent with my big mother thesis, that we're recreating the image of the mother's body through our technocratic society and the big nanny state and all that.
It's the next iteration of that.
Yeah. And of course it's no longer symbolic. The castration is become literal again. He says it was then symbolic, now it's literal. Well, now it's literal again. So I got a passage on page 150. Shall I read that?
Sure, go ahead.
As Walter Truant Anderson points out, it takes virtually no time in our culture for an idea to become a religion, and he cites as evidence the latest manifestation of Great Mother worship, namely James Lovelock's Gaia hypothesis, as an example. Anderson says that while the theory does have a real scientific core to it, The popular Gaia bandwagon could care less about such things. Instead, a collection of myths and metaphors of the Earth as alive, as a goddess, as having a mind of its own. These are the turn-ons, and they are what is being transformed into a new faith, a kitsch eco-theology, complete with its doctrines and its priests and priestesses. And now the Extinction Rebellion and Greta Thunberg as the avatar. So yeah, that was my last annotation.
Okay, well, I'll go ahead and finish the section.
Okay.
So he says, pull it all together then, and you get a pattern of rigidity and civilization that operates on both a socioeconomic level as well as a psychological or philosophical one. It is all too cloying, and the desire to break out of that shows up in the modern world, for example, in things such as paramilitary organizations and rodeo rancher culture, which are pathologies of another sort. Historically, the sacred authority complex and the totality of urban, sedentary, agricultural life, with the Great Mother thrown in later, provoked a response, an experiment designed by means of physical movement to do two very important things, to reject the suffocating totality and ideological certainty of agricultural civilization, and to restore paradox to the center of human consciousness. This was the phenomenon of nomadism, which gets to in the next chapter.
That's the end of this week's Liminalist, the podcast between. The next Liminalist, which will be this coming Saturday, is with Samuel Corwin, on which we'll be talking about the COVID contraction and dealing with the presence of masked humans and just the whole struggle and strain and stress of that situation, and a little glimpse into how the Galician project is unfolding.
Changes in the heart, changes with the time. Strangers in the night pass up and downtown. Changes in your soul.